Okay. Hi, I'm Rachel. I'm from the University of Michigan. I am going to talk to you some more about Michigan today. And so I actually changed my title a little bit because I'm going to be focusing a little bit more on the methods today of the transmission model that we've developed using some of the Michigan hepatitis C surveillance data to look at kind of more into transmission among young persons who are injecting drugs. So you probably remember this graph from the plenary session. Just to kind of give a little bit of context to, and the motivation behind the work that we wanted to do with this transmission modeling piece, I think everyone in this room probably knows that opioid use disorders, prescriptions, overdoses have all been increasing over the last like decade and a half. But it's important to think about other connections that may be going on kind of behind the scenes in opioid use disorders. So one population we were particularly interested in looking more into were persons who inject drugs, because that's another population that's really been experiencing increases in the prevalence of injection drug use, and especially among young adults in the U.S. And then we also wanted to study a bloodborne virus that particularly affected those individuals, which is hepatitis C. So this is an estimate that's a little bit dated right now, but one of the higher bounds that I've seen, which is that up to about 2.6% of persons in the U.S. inject drugs at some point in their lifetime. And we know that injection drug use, again, has increased among young adults in the U.S., although the numbers aren't quite as clear there. But it's clear that hepatitis C virus adversely affects persons who inject drugs. One study that I saw said prevalence in the U.S. was around 43% among PWID or persons who inject drugs versus somewhere in the ballpark of 1% among general people in the U.S. And again, I don't have numbers specific to young adults because, of course, this is kind of an emerging picture and an emerging epidemic. But it's important to note that, you know, in the same way as this graph shows, they're adversely affected by hepatitis C. So I stole this slide from the CDC. I didn't make it, as you can probably tell. And the CDC puts out reports on the incidence of acute hepatitis C in the U.S. over time. So I just wanted to touch on this quickly, because acute hepatitis C, really, if we're talking transmission modeling, which is some of the work that I'm doing, that's really a great measure of incidence, and that's what we want to be looking at in an emerging infection among young persons who inject drugs. And I think this data summarizes the main point, which is that, you know, you see the yellow and purple lines here, that the incidence of acute hepatitis C has really risen, especially since on this graph of around 2008 to 2009, versus some of the other age groups are staying more stable. I'm sure everyone in this room is very well versed on a lot of the challenges of conducting HCV surveillance. I know that I spent a couple years in Arkansas trying to get Hep C surveillance going on, and I definitely felt some of that pain. And I think this slide by Monina Clevens and others at the CDC kind of summarizes like a bunch of steps where we can miss cases of acute hepatitis C as we're looking for them in surveillance. So, of course, not every acute hepatitis C case has symptoms, so not all of them are going to seek care. And then even those who seek care may not be reported appropriately to their state health departments. So we end up missing a lot of cases. And in this paper, they ended up saying that somewhere in the ballpark of like 12.3 to 16.8 cases occur of acute hepatitis for every case that we catch in surveillance. And that higher bound, the 16.8 bound, is more specific to persons who inject drugs, just to reflect their kind of differences in healthcare seeking behaviors. And so many states have instead turned to their chronic hepatitis C surveillance data to look more into kind of the young persons who inject drugs and to look at changes in hepatitis C over time. So I stole this slide from Joe's group at MDHHS, and this is just a histogram of their reported cases in 2013 when Hep C was still past or present cases. And it's just by birth year. So we see, as expected, there's a peak at the 1945 to 1965 group. But then there's kind of this second wave after people born that like 1978 range. And those are really the group that we're interested in looking at transmission in, because theoretically these people aren't that old, so they had to get their infection relatively recently. But obviously these are being caught as chronic cases, not as acute. And I picked this. There are many good examples of this type of work from many different states, but I picked Michigan because obviously I work there, and this is some of the data that we use in our model. So So I am, some of the research that I do is transmission modeling. So as a last bit of background, I just wanted to kind of mention some of the work that's going on in transmission modeling right now for hepatitis C, because it's been kind of an exciting time to work in that. So obviously since 2012, a lot of the hep C landscape has changed. There are new direct acting antivirals that make hep C treatable. We have new testing recommendations, and the picture is really rapidly evolving as far as treatment. And some of the modeling work that's been done internationally has really helped to prioritize and make recommendations about who to treat for hepatitis C virus infections. Unfortunately, there's not tons and tons of studies done in the U.S., and I think that that's a testament to the fact that we don't have very fine-grained prevalence data everywhere in the U.S. But I really like this one paper by Echevarria et al. That came out in 2015. And this is one of the only papers that I've seen that did transmission modeling work among young persons who inject drugs, so persons who are under the age of 30. They had two ongoing cohort studies in Chicago where they were actually able to get a prevalence estimate of hepatitis C among their young PWID population in Chicago. And essentially what's kind of shown in this graph, which I wonder if I can point. So yeah, this is their kind of young PWID results, and they used some forecasting and transmission modeling to show that among a population that starts at a prevalence of about 10%, which is what their young PWID population was at the time, if they treated like 10 infections per 1,000 PWID per year for 10 years, they could reduce that prevalence like tenfold. Whereas compared to the total PWID prevalence, which started at a much higher prevalence of 47%, those gains after treatment were much smaller. So it's really, you know, I think that this study speaks to kind of the idea of treatment as prevention that's gaining more and more support in the literature, where, you know, we need to be considering some of the people who are actively injecting drugs as good candidates for treatment. So one thing that I'll just say before I kind of wrap up on this point is that this group was very fortunate to have this prevalence estimate, and I don't know that that's necessarily available in other locales in the U.S. So a big driver underlying the work that I'm going to present on in a minute was just, you know, thinking about other data sources that we could use to do this important transmission modeling work. And so I was really fortunate to meet Joe, actually, at a previous CSTE conference, and we decided to try to kind of do this as a project. So our objectives of this work were to first develop a hepatitis C transmission model that was fit to Michigan HCV surveillance data among young persons who inject drugs. And we did this during the period of 2000 to 2013. And we actually ended up using the newly reported chronic cases as our sort of data to inform this model. And then once we had the model fitting well, and I'll describe this more in a second, we used it to evaluate the potential impact of a number of different interventions. And I classified them kind of as primary, secondary, and tertiary, as we do in public health. So I'll walk you more through that in a minute. This part's going to be a little bit methods heavy, but I still think it's cool, so I'm going to do it anyway. So I'm going to take you through our modeling approach. First, there's kind of three big steps. Build the model, compile parameters so that we can actually fit the model to data in the second step, and estimate some of those parameters that we were not able to gather from the literature. And then the final third step was just simulating interventions using the parameter sets that were most consistent. Okay, forgive me for this busy slide, but this is a sort of a diagram that depicts what is actually a system of 27 ordinary differential equations, which is a common way to just build a transmission model, a compartmental transmission model, which is kind of very common in some of the hep C modeling literature that I'm sure all of you have been reading about. So essentially, we coded this up in MATLAB, and this figure basically represents all of the compartments that people sort of transition through in our model. So you can think of each box as containing people in Michigan. Our model represents the appropriate, you know, 15 to 30 age group in Michigan during the time period of interest, and all of the people transitioned through their respective boxes at the parameters that are the Greek letters here. So keeping that in mind, essentially what happens is most of the population starts in the white box, which is people who do not inject drugs, so I'm going to call them non-PWID. At an age-specific rate, phi, they start injecting drugs. We assume that they have not acquired HCV elsewhere. And then they transition into kind of this series of black boxes, which I'm going to call the current PWID group. Those are people who are actively injecting drugs. The susceptible current PWID, they acquire an infection through syringe sharing with an acute or chronic case, and they transition into the acute stage of their illness where they can either spontaneously resolve their infection, or they can, about 75 to 85% of them go on to develop chronic HCV, and then they can be treated at any time. We did allow for people to quit injecting drugs at any point in our model, so that's the transition from the black boxes to the gray boxes at the rate delta. That's our cessation of injection rate, and at any time they can also restart injecting drugs and go back into the black boxes. So all of these Greek letters are just like numbers that I found in the literature that I'll tell you more about, but essentially this is kind of how we formed our model. One other thing to mention is we did also incorporate mortality into this model, and that's through the rates mu right here. We actually also in the literature just found some numbers as far as the elevated mortality rate in PWID too, and included that. And then reinfection is possible, as is spontaneous clearance. Okay. So, like I mentioned, it's important to have numbers for your model, or else people don't actually move through the boxes. So the next step was really to do a big literature review and find the numbers that corresponded to all the rates in our models. When you do a literature review, you never just find one study or one number without confidence bounds. So it was really important for us to strategize about how to incorporate sort of that uncertainty in our model. So we chose to do that through basically resimulating the model 5,000 different times using a number of different plausible values for each parameter. And we did something called Latin hypercube sampling to do that. So not to get too into the details, but I think this graph shows it pretty nice. It's a type of stratified random sampling where, like here in the example, this parameter would be 0 to 1, this is 0 to 1. And because it's a stratified random sampling scheme, the whole parameter space is gridded up, and then you end up with samples in every part of the grid. Every row and column has a sample. Versus with random sampling, you need to do a lot more samples to get a good, even coverage of your parameter space. So that was just something that we kind of learned along the way as far as reducing the number of simulations that we would need, which is important because not everyone has a supercomputer, including me. So for example, just to kind of put this into context, one of the parameters we sampled was just the prevalence of current injection drug use. We had found a kind of United States age-relevant study that said around 0.9 to 1.3% of people might be injecting drugs at any point. And so we used that, and all the other parameters are kind of the similar idea. We just found papers that seemed relatively consistent that we sampled across. Okay. The other thing that we needed to incorporate in our model was some way to have people of different age groups interact, because I think in most hepatitis C surveillance data, including the data that we had, you don't necessarily know who someone contacts, who they share syringes with, who they got their infection from, and you don't know what age that person is. But we know that people of different ages interact at different rates. So I might not interact with someone who's 15 as often as I do with someone who's closer to my own age. So we adapted a study of social contact patterns to look into the mixing between our three age classes of interest, which are 15 to 19 years, 20 to 24, and 25 to 30. And those really helped us figure out how people are kind of sharing syringes in our model. Okay, the next up was parameter estimation. So this is really where we brought in our data, and we estimated four parameters, three injection initiation rates, and one transmission rate. This is really because you don't really get these exact values from the literature, so it was important to take advantage of the information that we had from the data to fit these parameters just via weighted least squares, which is just kind of similar to what you would do in regression. And we adjusted our cases for underreporting to surveillance using the paper that I mentioned before by Monina Clevens at the CDC. This basically allowed us to take what we found in the literature, which is not subject to underreporting, and make that consistent with data that is known to suffer from underreporting. So it was kind of the way that we kind of meshed those two disparate things together. So finally, we were once we were happy with the model, we selected the 50% of best fitting simulation, so 2,500 parameter sets, and we simulated a number of different interventions, including primary prevention initiatives, where we basically scaled down the injection initiation rates that we had. Secondary interventions, we were either decreasing injection partners, increasing injection cessation, or decreasing injection relapse. And I'm just kind of pointing to the parameters that are relevant here. Oops. And then tertiary interventions were really our hepatitis C virus treatment, where we were either treating people who are currently or people who are former injection drug users. Okay. With that methods in mind, I'll go through the results. So I'm going to take you through how we fit the model to data, the parameter sampling and estimation results, and then the intervention results. So in the end, we were able to get a pretty okay fitting model. Again, we simulated the model 5,000 times. So there are 5,000 lines on each of these graphs. And the color of the line indicates how well it fit to our surveillance data, which is the black points. And it's shown, you know, on the top is all age groups. On the bottom is by each age group. We see that overall, we did pretty okay with both parameter sets. Seems plausible as a pretty good fit to the data. But of course, there were those lines in green and purple that just, for whatever reason, those combinations of parameters couldn't support an epidemic trajectory. The epidemic died out. And those were the ones that really got excluded from the intervention simulation because it's very clear that they don't fit to the data at all, which happens when you review the literature and include a lot of uncertainty. So within each of those lines, each of the 5,000 lines, each one has a parameter set. So it has plausible values for all the different rates that we included to guide the transition between the boxes and the figure that I showed you. And we wanted to know, were any of these parameters more consistently fitting to the data in certain ranges of their sampled values? So this is an example with the prevalence of current injection drug use, where we kind of colored the histogram by the quartile fit to the data. So the light gray are like the best fitting parameter sets and the black are the worst. So when the distribution is skewed towards one side or the other, it kind of tips you off like, okay, probably our data in Michigan are supporting that the prevalence of currently injecting drugs among this age group is a little bit lower than that upper bound. Although, of course, there are some parameter sets that can support kind of that higher bound. I'm not going to go too much through the rest of the parameters, but the reason that it's important, the reason that this is important is just to give some idea of how the interventions are, under what conditions the interventions are performing. Okay, so finally, I need to kind of go a little bit quicker, but we took basically the last year of the predicted case counts for each of the best fitting simulations. That was kind of our no intervention case. And then we simulated a bunch of interventions and asked a couple of different questions to compare to these graphs. So the first one was really just what's the predicted impact of the primary versus tertiary interventions on incidence and prevalence? And when we look at this, we simulated the interventions at three different scales. So as the gray goes to black, that's scaling the parameter by 10, 20, or 40%, where we're just decreasing the injection initiation rates. These are violin plots, so they kind of show both the minimum and maximum value of prevalence and incidence, and then also kind of where most of the data lie. So it's sort of like a box plot. But basically what we see is primary interventions do pretty well for both reducing incidence and prevalence in our simulations. Tertiary interventions on the top, you can see, did really well at reducing prevalence, and they did okay in terms of reducing incidence, although not as big of an effect here for treating current PWID and reducing new chronic cases versus the primary interventions. So our last question was just how do the secondary interventions enhance the predicted impact of the primary versus the tertiary interventions? And for this, we basically summarized the data as the mean percent case reduction across the 2,500 different simulations that we did. We just plotted. Essentially, what's going on here is we have like one intervention in place, then this row adds a second intervention in place, then a third. And we swapped out which became the first intervention and looked at kind of the added benefit of adding each of these. So you can see when you start with primary intervention and then add secondary interventions that like decrease contacts or decrease or increase cessation, et cetera, you get pretty good reductions to both prevalence and incidence. But by comparison, when you start with treatment, we get similar reductions to prevalence, although the reductions to incidence kind of lag, especially when you start with treating former PWID versus current. And those kind of catch up over time as you add in the secondary interventions. Okay, every model has limitations, and this one is definitely not an exception. All models rely on a lot of different assumptions and simulations. This isn't empirical data, and it would need to be tested in that way if there were going to be actual interventions happening. We need to believe our model structure, our parameter values. We need to believe the mixing patterns and the syringe sharing patterns that we've kind of picked here are actually what's going on. We did apply a reporting rate that was developed for acute HCV to newly reported chronic cases. And the justification there is just really that these are young people, so we know that they had to have gotten HCV at some point relatively recently. And in this model, at least at this point, we haven't forecasted interventions. We're really looking at them in the counterfactual sense, in the what would have happened sense. And we assume that treatment was 100% effective here, so that should be like interpreted as the maximum effect. So finally, in case anyone is interested, we now have this method sort of up and running. So if it was of interest to, you know, try other surveillance data sources or something like that, I'm working on writing this up, and the code will be available at some point when my advisors allow that. And as far as our interventions, it looks like primary prevention is really important. So decreasing injection drug use really reduces both prevalence and incidence of hepatitis C. Treatment is so important at reducing prevalence, and it can really be complemented by secondary and primary interventions as well. Okay, I just want to thank a few people, my dissertation committee, obviously, because they've read this like 18 times. And then Joe, I just wanted to thank you for being so great about sharing data and being open to new ideas and being very patient in this kind of academic exercise. So appreciate it. Thanks. So I think it can, and a lot of the models that forecast into the future do show that. So I don't know that since we're kind of in the sense of what would have happened, that's a little bit harder to look at. That's one of the things that I'm thinking about, like, do I want to change the model to forecast in the future? And that would be like a better way to answer that question. The only reason we say, and so there, I didn't talk about it here, but there, the helpful part of looking more at the parameter sets specifically tell you when treatment would be very effective at reducing incidence. And in our model, at least, it looks like in scenarios where there's really high injection initiation and a lot of syringe sharing, that treatment would be like really effective in reducing incidence. But I didn't really have time to like go into all of that. But yeah, that's the nice part about doing the uncertainty analysis, is because you can like kind of hone in on when things do well. So yeah.
Hi, that was awesome.
Thanks.
And way over my head. So forgive me if you have this question. No, it was wonderful. But so you took into account the contact between the different clusters of age groups, but all within the young age group. Did you, and maybe you did mention this, but did you take into consideration contact with older age groups of injection drug users as well?
We didn't in this model, and I think that is, so in our model, we kind of just had to include parameters that were relevant to the data that we had, and we didn't include like anything out of 15 to 30, but I think you're totally right. Like in other models that look at a larger range of age groups, they sort of incorporate all of the different mixing patterns. Luckily, in the study that we used, they still have that information, so it's certainly possible. But then I think you run into more complications with, like, reporting rates and things like that that, I don't know, would also need to be accounted for, but great question.
I also really, really enjoyed your talk.
Thanks.
Were you able to find any, like, data on differences between your transition from your different boxes between, like, rural populations and urban populations? And were your estimates for the entire state of Michigan?
Yeah, so our data, we collapsed it for the entire state of Michigan. That's another big limitation, is some of the, you know, really the nuances in the surveillance data that are available get kind of lost in some of the work like this because it's so aggregated together. So yes, we focused all on Michigan, but I think one of the extensions of this work could be to kind of hone in and only use data from one area, one county, one city, or just rural areas of a state, and to really compare the results and see if they're consistent. And I think that's kind of a strength of this approach, is that, you know, you can kind of apply it as you will depending on your data source. But yeah, this is the first time that we've like undertaken this, so we did the whole state. Yeah.
Are you aware of other people who've done similar work?
Lots of people are modeling with hepatitis C right now, but I really haven't seen anyone adapt surveillance data. But if anyone knows anyone, I would love to meet them. Yeah. So let me know.
And is there a way we could get your references?
Yeah. So you mean like the papers that I referenced?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I can send you the PowerPoint version, and that has like the full citations and the notes and stuff if you want to just like give me your email or something.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Patricia from California, and I was curious if your model is able to incorporate access to syringe exchange, or if you guys thought about looking at that.
That is such a good question. So our model kind of was able to directly look as an intervention at decreasing syringe sharing, which would be like the outcome of a syringe exchange, you hope. But as far as directly saying, like, okay, we opened this many facilities, this is going to be the potential impact of that, I couldn't really speak to that just because of the model structure. But I think there are a few papers out that have started to look at that. I don't think we could apply it with this data, but I can certainly, like, look those up if you would be interested.